The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're coming to you live here at our Ed Stone studio. Beautiful Monday afternoon. Supposed to be another heat wave, at least a heat wave for the UK. So it's going to be warming up here later on this week, but it's just been beautiful these last few days as we head into the autumn months. Lots to get to, lots and lots to get to on today's program. There always is, well, every day, but certainly on Monday, as we just try to summarize some of the big stories as far as Bible prophecy is concerned. And first, we'll begin with President Trump, the peacemaker. You look back at the last week. What an incredible week for his administration. Just leaving aside prophecy for a moment, and considering all of the criticism that has come against this administration from the beginning. Last Wednesday, a member of the Norwegian parliament nominated President Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize for helping to broker the peace deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. And then on Friday, a member of the Swedish parliament, he nominates the president for his work in brokering a peace deal between Kosovo and Serbia. That was just last week. Two nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize. And on Friday as well, President Trump, and the reason why he has to tweet this out and then talk about it at press conferences is because the news won't cover it. The news media in the United States, they will not cover this. And so he announces on Friday another peace deal between Bahrain and Israel. Here is the little Middle Eastern nation of Bahrain recognizing Israel. This was the president's statement on Friday, clip 7.
There's no more powerful response to the hatred that spawned 9/11 than the agreement that we're about to tell you. You will hear something today that's, I think, very, very important for not only the Middle East, but for the world. In the spirit of peace and cooperation, both leaders also agreed that Bahrain will fully normalize its diplomatic relations with Israel. They will exchange embassies and ambassadors, begin direct flights between their countries, and launch cooperation initiatives across a broad range of sectors, including health, business, technology, education, security, and agriculture. This is a truly historic day.
A historic day, a pretty comprehensive deal, not unlike that with the UAE just a few weeks ago. And keep in mind, this is coming from President Trump, the warmonger, as his enemies point out, the tyrant, the authoritarian, he's Adolf Hitler. James Mattis says that came out in the Woodward book. Bob Woodward, we'll get to that in just a little bit. But here's this top general who actually floated the idea that we're going to have to get the military involved to remove President Trump. And here he is just making all these deals around the world. PJ Media says Democrats claim the whole world hates and disrespects Trump as much as they do. Yet here he is racking up foreign policy wins, Israel and the UAE, Kosovo and Serbia, and then Israel and Bahrain. He's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for the first two. Will he get a hat trick? Will someone now come along with the Bahrain deal and say, well, I think he should get a nomination for that as well? This is quite the track record. Quite a number of foreign policy victories, at least in the short term. His enemies in the U.S., of course, are not about to get on board with this, certainly not as a success. Nancy Pelosi, she's called this a distraction. Think about that. What would she say if Barack Obama was brokering a peace deal between Israel and the UAE, or Israel and Bahrain, or Kosovo? Kosovo as well is in on this. Serbia and Kosovo. Pelosi says, so good for him for having a distraction on a day when the numbers of people who are affected and the numbers of people who are dying from this virus only increasing. So forget about peace. Never mind peace in the Middle East. Never mind peace in the world. It's all things COVID all the time. COVID-19. COVID. Nothing else should even be considered. Now, we know, of course, in the long term, this is not going to bring peace to the region or to the world. Certainly not the world. But to consider this short-term progress made by an administration that these Democrats hate, to consider this a distraction? Well, he's there. President Trump was. He's in front of his supporters last night in Henderson, Nevada. And, of course, he's catching lots of criticism for this. I think this is his first rally in some time where he actually went indoors. He's been holding them outdoors near where the plane lands, Air Force One. But now he's back inside an arena of some kind. I forget the name of it. And he's criticized for that. But while he was giving his speech last night, he talked about these nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize and just how the news media totally ignore this. Here's clip 9.
So we were nominated a few days ago for a Nobel Prize, which is a big thing, Nobel Peace Prize. And then yesterday, we were nominated a second time for another Nobel Prize. Now, that's a big thing. To me, you know, it's a big thing, even though obviously it's a very political thing, but it's a very big thing, the Nobel Peace Prize, right? I got zero time on the nightly news, on the network news. Zero. Zero. We got zero time. Think of it. The president of your country is honored by being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And your nightly news, ABC, which is terrible, CBS, which is terrible, and probably the worst of all, owned by Comcast. They spend a fortune, you know, on PR. And then every time I get up, I call them Comcast and sort of wipe out their fortune. But they are bad people. But NBC is the worst of them all. Not one mention. These people are corrupt.
Not even one mention, he says there. That evidently was outdoors. I think that was in Reno, and then the next night he was in Henderson, indoors. In any event, you get a feel for what he's out there saying, even as the media, as he explained there, they completely ignore it. They do not care. Any foreign policy success is not to be covered. The Atlantic, they came out and said, I guess there was a column there, the calling on the Nobel Peace Prize Committee to put an end to the Nobel Peace Prize. It's time to put an end to it. That's the position of the Atlantic now. Now that President Trump has been nominated, Yasser Arafat won the Nobel Peace Prize, and that didn't really make the Atlantic think twice about this award and whether or not it should be issued. But President Trump, he gets a nomination and the heads explode at the Atlantic. And you know about the Atlantic. Remember the big story a couple weeks ago? Oh, the big reveal. Yes, indeed. President Trump, he called our vets, our war dead, losers and suckers. And that story has since been, well, there's been 25 people that have come forward and say, it's not true. President Trump also talked about this over the weekend, these people coming forward that were there in Paris and that have said there's nothing true about this Atlantic story. Here's clip 3.
And there's nobody that loves our military, respects it, and the people more than me. And they took... And I didn't even ask. We had 25 people that were witnesses that are on the record already that have said that never took place. It never took place, what they said.
25 people on record. And then following the Atlantic, of course, you've got the big Bob Woodward reveal. The fact that President Trump downplayed the significance of the virus. And that caused thousands and thousands of deaths. And as I pointed out last week, there was nothing to that story either. A president of the United States coming out with rhetoric that was intended to not cause people to panic. That's routine for that office. And yet here they are trying to make a big deal out of it. Even as you heard last week, all these Democrats are on record. They're on video as well. Downplaying the crisis back in February and March, and amid all of this hysteria last week over Woodward and his forthcoming book, there have been a few conservative commentators that have said the big reveal, really, that's there is that the former Defense Secretary, James Mattis, he told then-Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats that they might have to forcibly take down President Trump. This was actually discussed within the Trump administration. This was back when Mattis was at his post, the Defense Secretary. He's quoted as saying, according to Woodward, there may come a time when we have to take collective action. Because why? Well, because President Trump is dangerous. President Trump is unfit. He's unfit for office. When have you ever heard, until this administration, when have you ever heard this kind of open dialogue within government circles about a military coup? That's what this is. That's what's under discussion. There was a piece in the news stack today from The Revolver. Playing with fire, the Democrats and their allies flirting dangerously with the idea of a military coup. It says here, more and more ominous evidence is piling up that the U.S. military's near 250-year separation from national politics is eroding quickly. In fact, there are frightening signs that at least some senior members of the military are open to an anti-Trump coup d'etat, and that if such a coup happens, Democrats will cheer it on. Yeah, the Dems are all for it. Anything to take him down. Well, The Revolver talks about how that, look, we're writing this article and it's not based on any kind of insider information. We're not trying to, you know, say that we've got all these secret sources that have informed us on that. It's not based on anonymous sources like that Atlantic piece. It basically says we're just quoting. We're quoting what they're actually out there saying. We're referring to the headlines. It talks about the red flag that is raised in Bob Woodward's book. This book that's coming out soon, and what James Mattis says, and how that excerpt from that was in the Washington Post last week. And so here's the former Defense Secretary, James Mattis, saying there may come a time when we, the military, may have to take collective action. Because, well, he's dangerous, the president. He's unfit for office. Brad McDonald was saying this morning how that when you go back and look at some of the language in America Under Attack, or even before that, my father talking about a coup attempt or a coup d'etat, it would have been easy for some to look at those statements from several years ago and say, well, there's no way that anything like that could happen. And what a wild exaggeration for the trumpet to make. It doesn't look so wild and crazy now. Here again, tomorrow's news today. You can get tomorrow's headlines in the Trumpet magazine today or at the trumpet.com website today. Another piece here recently, just a few days ago, from The Federalist. The left is setting the stage for a coup if Trump wins. This is another reputable site. I know it's conservative, but still, setting the stage for a coup if Trump wins. And it says here, it's been hard to miss the steady drumbeat of articles and think pieces over the past few months about Election Day war games and post-election planning underway on the left, rooted in obsessive fears that President Trump will refuse to accept an electoral loss, triggering a constitutional crisis and maybe even widespread civic unrest, all in a desperate attempt to cling to power. This is what they obsess over. So, well, we're going to have to call in the military to finally put an end to this administration. And this Federalist piece, it gives all kinds of examples from the news media, the mainstream media, the Democrat media complex, just in the last several weeks, the last couple, 3 months. So this now is just a routine topic of discussion. The United States of America. And astoundingly, here you've got an administration that just continues to go forward with its agenda. Now a peace agreement between Bahrain and the little nation of Israel. Jared Kushner, by the way, he's the son-in-law of the president, the youngish son-in-law. I think he's in his late 30s now. But he's the one that's responsible for most of the heavy lifting when it comes to these peace agreements. Someone tweeted out, by the way, this New York Times article from February of 2017. This was early on in the Trump presidency, just a few weeks into it. And the New York Times wondered, can Jared Kushner, a 36-year-old real estate heir with no diplomatic experience, pull off peace in the Middle East? Can Jared Kushner really pull this off? He's only 36. He's into real estate. How could he orchestrate a peace deal? Well, look at where we are 3.5 years later. What is the New York Times saying now? Well, you look at this morning's newspaper. This is the New York Times. It says Israel's back-to-back agreements to normalize ties with the UAE and Bahrain to be marked in a signing ceremony at the White House on Tuesday. That's tomorrow. And the much buzzed about possibility that other Arab nations could follow suit are causing some Israelis to ask whether a deeper shift may, after years in the making, finally be underway in the Middle East. This is the New York Times this morning. The same Times that 3.5 years ago said, how can Kushner do this? He's 36 and he's into real estate. And now you have Israelis wondering if there's this seismic shift taking place in the Middle East. All of these nations now recognizing little Israel, something that Israel's been insisting on for decades. And only a couple of nations have even recognized them. Egypt, Jordan. And now all these other nations are falling into line. The New York Times says, could their country at last be gaining acceptance? That's speaking of Israel. Could they be gaining acceptance in a region as a legitimate member of the neighborhood? Could this really be happening? You can go back even to the early months of the Trump presidency, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, for example. Oh, this is going to set off World War III. Oh, there's going to be explosion of violence. Now two nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize. And it sounds like the businessmen are having more success than the politicians have had over the last several decades. You can see why there's so much hatred for this administration that is disrupting things. It's certainly breaking apart the status quo. Things are happening that haven't happened in 20 and 30 years, in some cases longer. Listen to Prime Minister Netanyahu's reaction to the latest deal between Israel and Bahrain. Clip 8.
A full 26 years from Israel's second peace agreement with an Arab state to the third peace agreement. And now it's taken us only 29 days from the third peace agreement to the fourth. What a change. I want to express my appreciation to His Majesty, the King of Bahrain, for joining the Circle of Peace. And my appreciation for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed from the United Arab Emirates for working with Israel and the United States to expand the circle of peace. I'm looking forward with enormous anticipation to meeting all four countries, Israel, the United States, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, in this great historic moment of peace next Tuesday in Washington, D.C.
That comes up tomorrow then, the big meeting of these four. But there's Prime Minister Netanyahu saying, look, it took 26 years from the last peace deal to the one with the UAE. That would be the Jordan peace deal back in 1994. So it took 26 years for the next one. And now from that one, it took 29 days. And then Bibi and others are saying there's going to be more. There's going to be more states in the Middle East joining with the UAE, joining with Bahrain. And Netanyahu also praised the president for orchestrating peace for peace deals, not land for peace. Those have been disastrous. But these are peace for peace. Bibi said this, we have invested in peace for many years, and now peace will bring us investments, big investments for the Israeli economy, which is very important. You know, think of the temporary resurgence here for not just Manasseh, but for all of Israel, particularly Ephraim and Manasseh and little Judah. It says all these agreements were reached through hard work behind the scenes for many years. They have turned into reality with the very significant help of our friend, U.S. President Donald Trump, and I wish to thank him and his team for their very important assistance. That's little Israel, very appreciative of Jared Kushner, you know, the real estate guy. He doesn't really have any diplomatic experience, and he's in his 30s. What could he do? What could he possibly orchestrate?
Well, they're beginning to develop a bit of a track record. Now, prophetically, we have to look at this under the light of Bible prophecy. For sure, there are those on the side of President Trump that are obviously taking the hype too far. Brian Hook, a State Department veteran, he said, I think historians will look back on these two peace agreements as the beginning of the end of the Arab-Israeli conflict. So he sees this as the beginning of the end of conflict between Israel and Israel's Arab neighbors. The Bible talks about the illusion of peace and how it's going to explode in violence. My father's talked before about how that any peace agreement that's made that doesn't settle the most disputed angle of all peace agreements that have been discussed, and that would be Jerusalem. Anything that doesn't solve the Jerusalem problem, that city obviously is clearly divided. It's not going to bring a lasting peace, as we know. And even really the significance of these deals that we're seeing, it has more to do with the Psalm 83 alliance that is anti-Iran. It has more to do with that than it is these nations suddenly being pro-Israel. In the short term, there may be some short-term benefit. Like Bibi said, it's going to help their economy. Certainly helping the United States. It's another foreign policy victory for President Trump. Notice what we wrote in the latest Trumpet. This is in October, the October issue. Brent Nottigall, he says, the United Arab Emirates and other Gulf nations are part of the anti-Iran alliance. The title here is Why the Arabs Embrace the Jews. Why is this happening? How could this happen? Well, it's all part of the anti-Iran alliance. It says, in this regard, they find their goals aligning with those of Israel and really with the United States now as well. The president, in an interview with Fox News over the weekend, he talked about how that blowing up the Iran nuke deal is really what paved the way for these various peace deals. Here he is in his sit-down with Fox News, clip one.
This is the first time in many, many decades that anything like this has happened. I can tell you that other countries are going to be signing onto it. We're going to sign a lot of countries in the Middle East. You might have peace in the Middle East going a much different route. The biggest thing that impeded us was that horrible deal that Obama made with Iran. It was the worst deal. Paid him $150 billion, $1.8 billion in cash. How do you approve? That's when I realized the presidency is very powerful. When you can approve $1.8 billion in cash, big plane loads of cash going to people that they have no idea who it is. So they did a terrible job, and we're doing a great job. I think we can say that with great security.
That's President Trump over the weekend talking about the
peace process in the Middle East, taking a different route, a clear change in direction, as my father has written, between this administration and the previous one. As he says there, they did a terrible job. And of course, it's somewhat political here between the two. No love lost between these two, President Trump or his predecessor. They did a terrible job, and we're doing a great job. It started with blowing up this alliance with Iran. Now that that has been done, look at all these nations coming forward, allying themselves with Israel, of all states. Why? Well, it's to provide opposition to this radical Islamist state, the King of the South, as it's prophesied in your Bible. We wrote in the latest trumpet, it says, although the Psalm 83 alliance may unite to counter Iran's rise, the Bible reveals that its main purpose will be very different. And then it quotes verses 3 and 4, where it says the objective here really is to blot out the name of Israel. That's quoting Psalm 83, verses 3 and 4. So there's a double cross that's coming. It is in the initial stages here. It is an alliance that is forming to oppose Iran. But more than that, it's going to be cutting off Israel from being a nation. It says the nations that the Jewish state is ready to sign peace deals with are the very nations that will eventually attack Israel. So there's a great double cross coming. That's what's prophesied, sadly. It says the nations that, well, I read that. It says these verses, listen to this. This is in the latest trumpet. Here again, tomorrow's news today. This is printed. It's out there now. Of course, we were writing this a few weeks ago following the historic deal between the UAE and Israel. Now you add Bahrain to the list. And then there's President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu saying there's probably going to be more. Probably more nations added to the list. And what do we have in our Trumpet magazine? What's the forecast? It says these verses indicate that the mainly Sunni moderate, more moderate Arabs will ally together and with Germany. So really, we're just paving the way for Germany to step in there. We're bringing the nations together that Germany will ally itself with. The Psalm 83 alliance, never before happened in history, and yet we're in the early stages of it developing even now, right now. It says these verses indicate that the mainly Sunni moderate Arabs will ally together with Germany and will take crafty counsel to destroy Israel. The scene is not one of enemy nations confronting each other in open war. It's one of deception. See, that's what's at play here. It looks great. People are saying peace, peace. I mean, when have these scriptures, like in Jeremiah 6 and Isaiah, that talk about the ambassadors of peace, and how that they're out there proclaiming peace. I mean, we've obviously talked about those verses for decades, but boy, they sure jump off the pages of the Bible now. It's one of deception, it says here, these alliances. This alliance will conspire to double cross and destroy Israel. The peace deal between the Gulf states and Israel is leading to the fulfillment of the Psalm 83 prophecy. That's what it's leading to. So in the short term, there's obviously lots for this administration to celebrate, particularly when you look at what their political enemies have said. But in the long term, there's nothing for our nations to celebrate in this. We've been going through First Thessalonians, the whole book in the last couple lectures with the epistles of Paul. Today we're coming into chapter 5. Of 1 Thessalonians, where it says, but of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you. The times and the seasons of the end times, it's talking about. This book talks about the return of Christ over and again. Right at the end of every single chapter, there's a reference to the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. And here God tells his people, his brethren, the members in his church, that look, you really do understand these big moves, these big significant moves in the world, as far as prophecy is concerned, as far as world events are concerned. Now the little things, there's some specific information, like in the Gospels, it says we don't know the time or the hour or the day and the hour. Acts chapter 1, I think, talks about us not knowing the season. But we certainly can know. There's a lot to be known. In the big picture, we know a lot with some of those smaller details. I mean, we actually do know the seasons. We know when it's at the door. Signs of the times. Verse 2 says, "For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord is so come as a thief in the night. For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." See, when they start saying peace and safety, then you better beware. You better beware, because then sudden destruction is coming. And that's talking about not only the prophecies that lead up to the tribulation enduring, but also the return of Christ itself, as it says in the previous verses, coming as a thief in the night, a time when people least expect it. They actually look at the United States, they look at some of these peace deals, and they think, you know, we're entering into a millennial type time here. There's finally peace in the Middle East. God says, beware, because sudden destruction's coming. Verse 4 says, "But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief." You see, we're not in darkness. We know. We're in the light. We're children of the light. We know because of God's truth. God's truth shines light on these events, and we can understand because of the sure word of Bible prophecy. Paul said, knowing the time, that now is the high time to awake out of sleep. As long as we're awake spiritually, as long as we're not sleeping spiritually, well, we can know the truth. Who would have ever thought that it would be a businessman who really made some pretty significant progress in bringing together, and from Manasseh, of all things, just putting it on a silver platter for that Assyrian beast power, putting it on a silver platter for that seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Well, we have lots more to get to on today's program. We're running out of time, as I can see, but we'll take a quick break and then return with some other headlines from over the weekend. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email some feedback, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I'm sure a lot of you saw the headlines of that ambush on those two police officers in Los Angeles. Those two deputies, pretty new to the force, as I understand it, just joined the police department a year, two years ago, sitting there in their patrol car in front of a train station in Compton, Los Angeles. And this gunman walks up to their car and just starts shooting at them. One of them is a woman who's the mother of a six-year-old. And the man, I believe, is 24 years of age. And they're both clinging to life. And then you might have seen as well video from bystanders who were there laughing and filming the scene as the ambulance pulled up, saying that those two cops, they got what was coming to them. Cheering them on. Those policemen were then taken to the hospital, where there was a small group of protesters as well, blocking the entrance to the emergency room, blocking the entrance for the vehicle to get into the emergency lane. And some of them were chanting, "I hope they die. I hope the police officers die." Sam was saying, just in all the reading he did this morning, you wonder if just how much of this was carefully coordinated and planned by the mob. The media, of course, will treat it like it's just one crazed lunatic. They probably won't even call him that. At least the president over the weekend called him an animal. And a lot of people didn't like that. Well, this is a human being. This is an animal that shot these two police officers, tried to kill them. Well, when you look at what happens when the police come under attack, like we wrote in 2015, police under attack. That's the last, in a lot of ways, that's the last line of defense. What happens, as we asked in that Trumpet magazine, what happens if you handcuff law enforcement? Well, we're seeing it, aren't we? We're seeing it happen. It's just turning into the wild, wild west. People roaming the streets with guns. Police officers coming under fire. And the president, of course, out there talking about law and order every chance that he gets, because he knows so many millions of Americans are just absolutely outraged by these events that are now becoming more and more common. Here's what the president said yesterday in Nevada, clip two.
"And we also believe that if you murder a police officer, you should receive the death penalty. And that's something that's very important."
The president there saying that if you kill a police officer, you should yourself be killed or receive the death penalty. There was another incident involving a police shooting in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. This happened over the weekend as well. Another small city, not unlike Kenosha. We'll wait and see if it gets as bad as it did in Kenosha. There are agitators there, even at this moment, trying to stir up hate, trying to stir up violence. This one started when this woman called the police on her brother, some kind of domestic dispute. And as soon as the officer arrived, the woman was trying to get out of the house, and then the brother bolts out of the house, wielding a knife, lunging at the police officer. And the police officer ran a few steps away and then turned around and fired at the man and killed him. And so how do you suppose it's reported on social media? How do you suppose it's discussed on social media? Here come the police. They're gunning us down. They're hunting us down. And even the media, which is just shameful on every level, the media, they're suggesting that this officer, with just a split second to make a decision, should have decided on something other than fatally shooting the perpetrator. This knife-wielding lunatic. So now the crowds are gathering in Lancaster, outside the local police station and such. They're hurling bricks, and more are joining them. Here again, it doesn't take long for Antifa or whoever else to get in there. They probably come in from the big cities first, Philadelphia or wherever, and then even from farther away. As all these radical left-wing agitators, these radical left-wing groups, in some cases pay these agitators to go into these cities and to destroy, to smash up businesses, to burn down businesses. That's the United States of America. You talk about the open discussion from military sources about a coup d'etat. Here's another story or subject that you just couldn't have imagined. A few years ago, or maybe a decade or two ago, you just couldn't have imagined this. In the United States of America, people just walking down the street, I saw a clip just before coming up here, someone hurling a brick at a post office window. I forget where the city was, but these things, they get away with it, and they're all filmed. And it's all over Twitter. And nothing is done, for the most part. I know Attorney General Barr, Operation Legend, and so on, I know they've had some, certainly some crackdowns in cities. But how do you control this if local law enforcement won't uphold the law, law and order. They just turn over the streets to the criminals. This article from Wall Street Journal, I didn't have time to get to this last week, but it says here, as the Democratic Party moves to the left this year, it's spending time and energy hoping voters don't notice the consequences of progressive policies. And then it talks about all of these resignations, police chiefs and stuff and such, and it points out the African-American leaders that are stepping down because of the violence and the mayhem, because of this push, this movement to defund the police. It says here, in one day this week, and I think this article is a week old or so, it says two black police chiefs resigned under pressure. Renee Hall in Dallas, the first black woman to head that police's that city's force, and LaRon Singletary in Rochester. Last month, Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best, a three-decade veteran of the force, quit in protest over the progressive city council's plans to defund the police. It says Rochester's Chief Singletary didn't go quietly. In a bitter statement Tuesday, he said, "As a man of integrity, I will not sit idly by while outside entities attempt to destroy my character." This is a black police chief. The title of this piece in the Wall Street Journal, "Black Cops Don't Matter." They don't matter. The lives of these black police officers, they do not matter. They've got to be fired. They've got to be run out of town for justice, right? Does that make sense? Upside down world. It says perhaps the most prominent African-American police chief resisting the progressive offensive against cops is Detroit's James Craig. Earlier this week, a group of Democratic politicians, including Michigan Rep. Rashida Tlaib, sent a letter to Chief Craig and other city officials urging an outside investigation into Detroit police tactics. Chief Craig fired back. So they're going after this guy, another black police chief in Detroit. Craig said, "What really disturbs me is that when the protesters assaulted Detroit police officers with rocks, railroad spikes, and fireworks, never once did these representatives ask for an independent investigation into their violent criminal activity." Rashid Tlaib, she could care less about the violence of these criminals that have taken to the streets. And yet, if the police respond in any way, they come under immediate investigation. They come under the microscope immediately. Every little move. What happens if he lunges at you with a knife? Well, you can't shoot him. You just have to kind of be careful that you don't get stabbed. But somehow or another, you've got to subdue him, I guess. Easy for these critics to say. What would you do if you're in that situation? What would you do if he lunges into the vehicle and grabs who knows what before turning around? It's just, well, it's third world. It's like it's the third world in the United States. And you've got all these hundreds of millions of guns and people buying them up by the millions. All these millions of new gun owners. Boy, Ezekiel 5, Ezekiel 4, Isaiah 1 and verse 7, Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26. Quite a few prophecies spring to mind. Together with all this, you have these devastating wildfires in Oregon, just burning out of control. The New York Times today says, across a hellish landscape of smoke and ash, authorities in Oregon, California, and Washington battle to contain mega wildfires on Sunday as shifting winds, the hot, dry winds, it's making matters worse. These flames are spreading all over. This article says that it's consumed now 5 million acres along the West Coast. 5 million acres! And then all of these communities, all of these houses, 24 people died just last week from these many fires. It says in the New York Times, the choking smoke cast a dark pall over the skies and created a vision of climate change disaster. Of course, it's climate change. That's the cause. That's what L.A. Mayor Garcetti said. This article quotes the Oregon governor, who says that we've not seen anything like this. We're feeling the acute impacts of climate change. How about this story from a local ABC affiliate in Oregon? It says an Oregon man was charged with arson in connection to a raging wildfire that destroyed hundreds of homes, one of the blazes gripping the West Coast with death and devastation. Well, I guess climate change made him do it. I think four people have been arrested in Oregon. Arrested for starting these fires. Here are human beings, lawless human beings. And of course, Twitter, Facebook, they're going to go to great lengths to just try to delete tweets that say, you know, well, what if these are Antifa thugs? Can't say that. Come on. We don't even really want you talking much about arson. Leave that aside. There's millions of acres burning, and it's climate change. That's what's responsible. End of discussion. And anyone that would deny it, like the governor of California said, I have no patience for it. Well, does he have any patience for these people lighting the fires? How about that? It's just like the people smashing the businesses. No investigation into that from Rashid Tlaib. Oh no, we've got to investigate the authorities. We've got to investigate the ones upholding the law and order. They're hardly even doing that today, are they? That's the West Coast. California, Oregon, Washington. And then, of course, you have the ongoing slow motion crisis of continuous, never-ending lockdowns because of the virus. COVID-19, coronavirus. Today is the first day for the new regulations here in the UK. The regulations that state no more than six people can gather together without risking a fine. Why? Well, because there have been some outbreaks of infections. There's still not many deaths to speak of. That's totally flattened. The curve has been smashed, flattened, everything. But because they're testing more, there's more cases. More cases of a lot of people that haven't been really impacted by it, not in a sense that they're sick, but never mind. The virus is there, and until the virus is completely stamped out, until no one on Earth, until no one in the UK has the virus, we've got to take all these precautionary measures, these draconian measures or regulations. Here they're making these things up as they go, and it's affecting tens of millions of people in Australia, in Victoria, here in the UK, in Scotland, Wales. The rules, the latest round of rules, it was published just this morning, I think like five, ten minutes before it went into effect. Can you believe this? No wonder people are out there wondering what to do. Some wear masks, some don't. Everyone's confused. You think about that in contrast to God's laws. They've been around for thousands and thousands of years, longer than that, because the laws really, as Mr. Armstrong used to explain, they just sum up God's way of life. This is the way God and the Word lived for eternity. The way of love, the way of give. And we can come along millions of years into this plan, this purpose that's being worked out here below, and study God's word and study God's truth and see that it's right up to date. It's exactly what we need. It's exactly what this world needs. God's laws. Well, it needs God's government too. Because man's government has failed over and over and over again. Here they are putting into place all of these new draconian laws every day, every few weeks. And who knows? Who knows when the government will realize that, well, they need a new set of laws. I just saw a clip this morning on the BBC. They were interviewing a virologist, and the interviewer was saying, now, how did you come up with the number six, okay? There's six, not seven, not five, but it's six, right? So what's the significance of six? And he went on to explain in a very erudite manner that, well, according to the models, we put some numbers in and then what comes out. And so what we've arrived at is kind of the average. And so it's six people. It's six people. If it's seven people, well, the disease will just spread all over the place. Keep it at six and we might be able to keep this under control. Don't you know? The models say so. Come on, get with the program. And so here are all these new rules and regulations in force just a few minutes after they're actually released. And then you get into the weeds on these regulations, the details, the exceptions, like support groups. If it's a support group, whatever that means, or a significant event gathering, whatever that means. Thankfully, there's some lenience. There's some leniency for church gatherings. We appreciate that for sure. But then it goes into the rules and the regulations for mingling, whatever that means. So what defines mingling? As far as a law or a regulation is concerned, well, you decide, I guess. Someone was writing today, I don't know if it's in the Telegraph or some other piece, where they were like, it's probably the first time in any kind of legislation that the word mingling has appeared. Mingling? So there's regulations on mingling now? Try to keep up with it, if you will. On radio today at the BBC, you had this policing minister, Kit Malthouse. He told listeners that, you know, if you see seven people next door, then you probably would do well to call the authorities. Here's clip five.
You think or you see seven people in the next door neighbor's garden. Should you ring in and report that neighbor?
Well, it's open to neighbours to do exactly that through the non-emergency number. And if they are concerned and they do see that kind of thing, then absolutely they should think about it.
Well, if it's now the law, they should be concerned,
yes.
Shouldn't they?
Yes, they should.
So they should ring in and report that neighbour.
Yes.
Sure, ring in, report them. Tell on your neighbours. Isn't this nice? Britain, the United States, the birthplace of freedom and liberty. It all started here. And now this is where we are. If you see seven people next door in the house, call the police. Boy, this is just like Wuhan. This is like China. Well, just to give you an example of how chaotic it is when you've got, on the one hand, the police minister saying what you just heard there, and then you've got all the critics that are basically out there as well saying, you know, just disregard these regulations. There's no way it can possibly be enforced. Here's clip six.
Well, I think that I agree with the last speaker that we are a long way from a Stasi-style surveillance state, and that's why these particular regulations are unenforceable. They would only be enforceable with an army of snoopers and informers, and that is the kind of thing that the police rightly abhor and that the rest of the public rightly abhor.
Do you encourage people, if they feel strongly, as you do, to flout these laws?
I would say that people should make their own decisions in the light of their own health, and that the law should be a secondary consideration for them.
That's Lord Sumption. We've quoted from him before, the former justice at the Supreme Court of the UK. He's basically saying, you know, he's asked if we should flout these laws, and he said, well, make your own decisions. Make your own decisions. There are a few MPs that are starting to speak out against so many of these regulations, which don't even work their way through Parliament. They're just handed down from the elites, the health experts, in so many cases. Here's one last bit from BBC, clip four.
We have new rules that will intrude into our family life, our social life, huge intrusion into individual liberty. We are to be marshalled in the streets, apparently, by marshals. What on earth does that hold out for us? I think that this is outrageous. These laws have been made without consultation in Parliament, without debate in Parliament, without a vote in Parliament, and we call ourselves a democracy. It's ridiculous.
There's an MP that obviously is not happy with what's happening, and yet it continues. How far along are we into this? 170, 180 days. So much for the 15 days to stop the spread. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal, by the way, about New York, the worst hit state. And it gives some details here about Andrew Cuomo's catastrophic failures. 11,000 people in elderly care centers that died because of this man's decree on March 25th? If you're sick with it, put him back in. You've got to accept him into your facility. There was one nursing home in this article, by the way, or talked about in this article, that did not obey that order. They would not receive sick patients into their elderly care center. And you know what happened? They had no one die from COVID-19. They had zero COVID-19 deaths. That's what you had to do to save people's lives. You had to disregard these rules and regulations handed down from on high. Andrew Cuomo, he knows, right? Oh, he knows. If he says it, it's the law. And one center disobeyed the law, and wouldn't you know it, zero deaths as a result. One final headline here from the London Times about Sweden, how that they're trying hard not to gloat over the fact that they didn't lock down the economy. And they were told that you're going to have 180,000 people die because of it. As it is, they've had 5,000 deaths. And their economy continued right on from the beginning, from day one. No lockdown. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the programs and comments, td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.